Veterans salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Jacob Novoke, who is the CEO of GenVid. We are here to discuss a pretty exciting, fun new project that he and his team are working on that combines video games, mobile gaming, and television and comic books. And there's just all sorts of interesting connections here. The world of interactive storytelling is a growing and fascinating one. So I'm pretty excited to have Jacob on today. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here.
So let's talk. All right, first off, let's talk about the project that you're here to discuss today, which is DC Heroes United. And then we'll get into the backstory of how this whole thing came to be. But I want you to explain to folks what this is, like what the actual project is, and how again the interactivity of it all works.
Sure. So DC Heroes United is an interactive streaming series. And usually when you think about interactive streaming series, you think of something like Bandersnatch, where you're just doing choose your own adventure. But that's not what this is. Mm-hmm. The community each week is coming together to decide what happens for the television show. So the television show is actually being built by the audience who are watching it weekly. The decisions that the audience makes for the canon, for the characters, becomes the canon of the television show. In addition, there's a mobile game that affects what happens in the television show, and the show affects what's happening in the mobile game. So the two of them are actually updated and in sync with each other every single week. So as events happen in DC Heroes United, as new heroes appear and new villains appear, they appear inside of the game. As new locations occur inside of the TV show, they occur inside of the game, and they update with each other each week. The way in which you affect the television show, the way in which you make decisions for what should happen to Batman or Superman or Wonder Woman, is by playing the game. So the more that the audience together, cumulatively, plays the game, the more that they are affecting what happens inside of television.
Right. So this is like a perfect description. I've seen gameplay on the game. I haven't actually played it myself, but I've seen the gameplay, and I've watched the first episode of the show, and it's interesting. So we'll just... To set the stage for folks, this is kind of the dawn of the DC universe, right? Batman is early on the scene. Nobody has actually named Superman. Isn't even named yet. He's just this blur in the sky. So we're kind of being introduced to everybody as the show goes along. At the start, even Lex Luthor's a good guy. You know, who knows if that will change. My understanding is that's one of the plot points here. But as the show goes along, there are little QR codes that pop up with, you know, there's going to be a story choice here. And folks who are watching and playing along at home get to decide how to move the story forward. What is the process by which they do this? Do they have to earn points? How do you get to that decision point?
So each week there are decisions. The first episode has three of them that then conclude in the next episode. The second episode's going to have five, and also call back to what happened in the first. And so these decisions get opened throughout the week leading up to a new episode. It's built almost like an episode of South Park, in which we're kind of creating it in the days leading up to the episode, because every week we have to build new television based off of the audience choices. And the way in which the audience impacts it is through what we call story tokens. We could have done kind of like standard American Idol style voting, but you know, we want to reward the people who are our most engaged users. So you get a story token by logging in each day, by participating in the gameplay. You don't have to be good at the game. You just have to play it to get those story tokens, by participating in the chat. So there's a live chat that happens around it. And basically just being part of the community. So the more that you participate in the community, the more story tokens you get, the more story tokens you have, the more you're able to participate in the influence. Now, you can't earn more story tokens than, say, some other user. It's impossible for a user to get like a million story tokens a week. There's only, you know, a couple that you can get, but it's more than one. So if you end up with 10 story tokens, you'll have, you know, 10 different votes that you can apply toward those different choices, however you so choose to do so.
Yeah. And the I love this, you know, for folks who don't know, South Park kind of famously is built in such a way using computer technology and so forth. It was one of the first animated shows that could almost be shot in real time. Like you could almost craft an episode during the week that would respond to things that had happened that week. It was, you know, one of the reasons why it became so popular and so huge. And you have there are three story choices in the first week. There are five story choices in the next week. You know, there's more and more, and they kind of branch out as you go.
Yes.
You guys have already put together a story chart that has some insane number of permutations. What was the I forget what the actual number?
158. Yeah, and it's massive, and they call back to each other. So like, you can't build a television show where in episode 7 they just kind of ignore everything that happened before. It's not like the old Star Trek serials, right? Nobody accepts TV that way. And so if you make a decision for what's going to happen in Lois and Clark's relationship, which is one of the first story choices, you would have noticed the prompt in episode 1 when Lois is meeting Superman for the first time. We're going to have to make a decision as an audience on whether, you know, Superman is going to tell her that, you know, he's Clark. And whether that happens or not drastically affects their relationship permanently forever. Mm-hmm. Right. And so this is going to need to be called back to on episode and on episode and on episode and episode in this season, in future seasons and beyond. So we have to build the scripts, not just about the choices and folding the choices back, but all about the references that happen later. So when we did, for example, last year's Silent Hill title, there was one scene that could have had 45 different permutation of that one scene alone based off of previous audience choices.
That's wild. That is, I mean, it's I just sit there and think about the poor writer's room, you know, having to work through all of these guys. How many I assume you have like kind of a constant team of writers, just, you know, all right, this is you have it all mapped out, but you still have to actually do the mapping.
Correct. At its peak, when everybody was working together, there were about 15. And that's writers, and that doesn't include the narrative designers, which is a completely separate category, which doesn't normally exist. And the narrative designers are the people who write the choices in an interesting way, which is to say how you structure a choice, the words that you use to get the audience engaged, radically change one, an audience member's understanding of what that choice is, but also their desire to participate in it. You can make it an interesting choice or you can make it a really boring choice. So like you could say, should Clark tell Lois he's Superman? Or you could say, should they know about each other? And like, they're actually the same question, but one is very direct and you can have an opinion on, the other one is kind of vague and not interesting. And I'm not giving a particularly good example because I'm trying not to spoil stuff
happens
in it. But you can see just by word choice, you create a desirable, you know, impact versus something that's kind of blasé. And so our narrative design team come from a studio called Telltale Games, which is known as one of the best game developers, you know, in history to build these narrative products. They won an award for their Walking Dead titles and other titles before. And there are very, very few people in the world who are extremely good at narrative design. I think we've got, you know, the collection of the people who excelled at it the most. But it is a hard job.
I'm sure, and I want to dive into something because this is a really interesting split in how we think about art and storytelling. There's a distinction between narrative designers and screenwriters, and they are doing different things, right? Like a screenwriter is, he sits at a desk by himself, or he goes into a room with people, and he's like, "Here's the story that's being told. This is all there is. I am guiding you down this path." And a narrative designer, the way you're describing it here is that it is not, it is kind of both screenwriting in the sense of we have story choices we have to make,
yes.
But it's also, you know, we need to make this fun for people to play, to keep them
yep.
involved, to keep them coming back week after week.
Exactly. And so these choices, because that's, you know, one of the biggest parts of what makes the series different than just standard television, are the crux of everything that we would call the game in this case. And so you have to make that game as compelling as you would have to make different choices for who you would put on American Idol, you know, or Dancing with the Stars, which my wife is watching in the other room right now. So, you know, this is what draws people in each week, and how you design it and how you create compelling choices basically decides whether the audience does or does not want to come back.
Yeah. And let's talk about the actual game itself here, because I am not a mobile gamer. We were talking about this before. I'm not a mobile gamer. I do like God of War once every 4 years or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, that's more my speed. But the actual game design here is pretty interesting and, kind of brings together a lot of disparate elements, both from DC and just like general mobile gameplay. Yeah. How did you balance all that?
We built many products at this point in time. I think that this is our seventh title. And we started with very casual puzzles in the past of like, here are things people like to do. They like to do match three puzzles, and they like to do memory match puzzles, and just popular, quote unquote, generic casual games. And we found that in some cases that worked, like for specific IP that was interesting, but for others it just doesn't fulfill any fantasy and or it doesn't match particularly well with the IP. So in doing DC, which is a very action-oriented genre, we were looking for successful mobile-type products that could fulfill the fantasy of being a superhero or helping a superhero or participating in a superhero. And there's a genre of mobile game right now that's incredibly popular called survivor games, which are really, really hard games where thousands of enemies come at you at the screen and your hero just kind of automatically throws weapons at them or shoots at them, and you just have to move them around. But if you don't play well, if you don't move them around well or pick the right upgrades for your character, you will quickly be overwhelmed and die. And that seemed like it would fit the superhero genre very, very well. So we built a survivor-style game, which is called a roguelite in game developer parlance. Rogue means that it's like a dungeon, you know, that's mm-hmm. randomized and things happen repeatedly. And light just implies that it's very easy to play. Like, you don't have to be a hardcore gamer in order to be able to win at it. And we decided to design it around the superhero fantasy of just being ultra powerful. So you've got massive waves of enemies coming at you, but you know, any superhero would be overwhelmed if they had an army of 1,000 people attacking them, right? But over the course of playing these levels, you get more and more upgrades of new superpowers that you are able to, you know, win against these crazy odds. And it starts to feel like you're playing, you know, a television show as you're going through it, and you're getting better and you're getting better and you're getting better over the course of your, say, 10-minute play session. So yeah. It was the perfect genre for us to participate in. And then there was just the question of, well, how do we make sure that this gameplay matches with what's happening in the television show, which was its own unique problem?
Explain that to folks. What was the issue there?
So we wanted to do something that I think has never been done in media ever before, which is take a weekly television show and tie it to a weekly updated game. Like, games these days get updated in what we call live service schedules, right? Fortnite updates every Tuesday. And every Tuesday there is new content. And most games that are live service games do that. So we wanted to create a schedule that actually allowed for you to update this game as the television show was updating each week. So when you play the game on day one, there are four different maps that correspond to the first episode of the television show, and the characters that are there correspond to the first episode of the television show. But when you come on week two, we're launching on November 20th. If you come on November 27th, you will have a new character there. It's already kind of spoiled in our opening title. It's Blue Beetle. So he appears in episode 2. So Blue Beetle will be unlocked on week 2 of the show, and a new map will appear. And the following week, a new map, more characters, and so on and so forth. So these characters are being added. How do you create a cohesive mental framework for the user for this? And so what we decided was, for the first time, to build it into the show itself. So you mentioned a few minutes ago that Lex is a good guy. He's actually building the initial Justice League. He's sponsoring it with his cash. And he is using his resources at LexCorp to create a simulation of how different superhero and villain powers combine so that this nascent Justice League can better combat the threats that are coming to it. So when you open the game, it says at the top, LexCorp, you have Mercy, who's Lex's assistant, welcome you, and say, welcome, new researcher. Thank you for participating in the simulation. So what's happening each week is Lex is running a simulation. This roguelite dungeon that you're playing as a player is actually a simulation being run by Lex on the TV show. And Lex, in episode 1, you see a scene where he flips it open and he says, I built the simulation. We're going to get updates each week. And as the television show updates, Lex is going to talk about what the audience is doing inside of the game. So as millions of people play this game, it's going to change what Lex does in the TV show. It's going to change what he says. And the research that you, the audience, are doing are going to unlock different weapons and strategies for the Justice League over time. So if we're seeing that, for example, a million people are playing as Batman and they've unlocked XYZ secret weapon inside of the game, we're going to unlock that in the television show that week. And so we've built this cohesive kind of story structure around the gameplay so they don't feel artificial or alienated from each other.
The and the TV show itself is airing on Tubi and I believe at the DC Comics website, right? That's
correct.
That's where
yes.
That's where folks can watch. Tubi's an interesting choice, and you know I'm curious about the decision making here, but also just the fact that so much stuff is going to these kind of free streaming advertising based services. What was from your point of view as a game designer, as somebody who wants to get people to the actual app to play it, why go to Tubi as opposed to somewhere that's, you know, gated off?
The most important thing to us was customer acquisition and getting to the largest audience possible, which is particularly hard with, you know, paywall gated streaming services, and particularly for age ranges of like 20 to 35, which is a key target gamer demographic. They may not be subscribing to many different streaming platforms, but they have access to these fast platforms, and they're definitely on YouTube. I think if you look at the audience base for Tubi, it's definitely within our age range, and also the demographic is a demographic that loves superhero stories and is very interested in superhero stories. If you go to Tubi, they often have a DC property, like a Wonder Woman movie or something else, on their homepage. And so they just have huge audience, which is what we are looking for as a game developer, because that connects back to our business model. In other words, we did not approach this as we're producing television, we're looking to sell it to a party. That's not the way that this was built. I think that model only works if you are a very large-scale existing network, right? Anybody other than that cannot produce an individual show and distribute it profitably. Otherwise, we'd see 1,000 different distribution companies cropping up regularly and just building their own TV networks. That's kind of the YouTuber model and not a television-based model. So for us, we looked at it as we're going to monetize this product as a video game. And what that means is creating skins for people to buy so you can dress up your character inside the simulation as like a 1960s Batman or like a classic Lex Luthor, a alternate universe Wonder Woman. We've got lots of different skins. You can get different equipment to help you get better inside of the game, and you have chests that you can open similar to most mobile games. And that allows us to monetize this as an individual piece of content, as opposed to how you traditionally monetize television, which is just scale a back catalog. Yeah. And so in order to monetize this as a game, you need as many users as possible, which brings us back to using Tubi, using YouTube as a customer acquisition form to get people to participate and monetize the game, as opposed to trying to monetize the content purely as content. We're treating the content basically as marketing.
Yeah. That's, I, again, it's all very, it's all, this is going to sound weird to say to you, I'm sure, but this is all so modern. It feels very, you know, new, and, you know, this is the future of interactivity and Fortnite and Roblox and all those. I just find it all almost unsettling in the, you know, just the sea change it really suggests.
And I think that as you look at where audiences are going in the future, like, this is definitely the direction that if you are a teenager, if you are a 20-something, you are used to this model for video games. You are used to content being free on YouTube or on Twitch or somewhere else. And you are not used to ads. So I'll give you a funny example. My kid is 7. And he was 3 when the pandemic started. We were in Manhattan in a, you know, one-bedroom apartment. He's stuck there. I'm stuck there. My wife is stuck there. And, you know, we do what most parents did, which was we had to work. So we give him a phone, and he plays with YouTube and gets used to that. And I remember one day he walks up to the television, tries to tap the television to skip an ad on the TV, and it doesn't work, and he's crying. He doesn't understand why you should watch ads, because, you know, he's 3, and he always presses the button. And at 3-year-old, he already knows that he can press that skip button on YouTube. And if you look at, for example, Matthew Ball's charts, and Ball is an executive producer on this project and a close friend of ours, he's showing recently that Roblox from 2018 has this massive, massive, massive growth of hours played on the platform from these young teens. These are generations that are growing up assuming content is interactive. They are assuming that they can engage with it. They watch Twitch and YouTube every day. They are used to commenting. They are used to the people who are doing the streams responding to their comments. They are used to games that they build and communicate together with their friends and communities. And so if we build content the way that we have been building for our generation that are used to it, we are going to be building, you know, content for a generation that's quickly aging out. And so I think that interactivity is going to be expected by default for the generation coming a decade from now into its kind of maturity of core spending. And how we address the fact that they've grown up interactive native is going to be really important to us as creators.
Yeah. No, it's again, it's just wild. I feel like this is a good opportunity to go back and talk about how you guys your first forays into this with Facebook and elsewhere. So, the project that you did with Facebook, the way you were describing it to me was so interesting, just as a oh God, what's the reality show? The
Big Brother.
Big Brother, but a video game. Which, again, it's just a bizarre melding of concepts here, but one that obviously was pretty successful for you guys.
Yeah, so in 2020, in the middle of the pandemic, we created Rival Peak, which the request from Facebook, who financed the show, was build us an interactive version of Big Brother. So similar to Big Brother, we had 24/7 live streams. We had a weekly television show. Unlike Big Brother, they starred no real people. So they were all video game characters who were streaming 24/7. We had 12 different characters. And every week we kicked off a character from the show, but it wasn't based off of voting. It was based off of how the audience engaged and helped those characters. So every character, every day, for months, every single day, had different tasks that they had to accomplish, and the audience, as they're watching the live streams, could assist, tap on this, craft that, cook that for them, in helping them accomplish those tasks. And the character that got the most help was Safe, and the characters that got the least help that week were basically booted off the show. And every week we had Will Wheaton host a show, which was the companion digest that explained what happened that week, which audience member got kicked off, sorry, which video game character got kicked off of the show, interviewed these fake characters, which is really fun because we used these real-time animation things 4 years ago in the earliest days of it, of like, you know, lip sync and other stuff. I mean, there's real actors behind the thing, right? But like, he's interviewing these video game characters. How does it feel to be booted off the show? And they're all reacting in real time because we're building that TV show each week in real time. So what would happen is on Friday evenings, we would cut off the audience score. On Saturday and Sunday, we're editing the scripts. On Monday, Will is filming in the studio. Tuesday, we're editing the episode. Wednesday, the episode premieres, and the new game content premieres with that episode that week. And, you know, the live streams are constantly live throughout the week, which then restarts everything toward the following Friday. And so we set up the dominoes here. Like, we created the cast of characters. We created the environments they would go into. But like a traditional reality show, we didn't actually know, you know, what was going to happen. We had no clue which character would or would not win. We didn't know who would survive until the end. And so it was a big mystery for us as creators as well.
Did you find any patterns of user behavior in terms of what they found appealing, what sort of characters they found appealing? I know we discussed like nations and like where people were from and how that impacted. What were some of the patterns you saw as users were interacting with these, again, digital video game creations, not you know, real people? These are video games. It's
yep.
Avatars, if you will.
Yes. So, you know, first of all, it was a Facebook product, so we tried to build characters toward a more global Facebook audience. So we had a character from India, we had a character from Africa, we had characters from Latin America. And we found very strong correlation between the audiences that supported that character and where their region was. So you could see the Indian players watching more of the Indian character and supporting them and so on and so forth. And it almost became like a, you know, kind of global rally in that form. So that was a very interesting, we theorized that was the case, and it was fascinating to see it actually be true. The next thing that we found was that traditional television tropes work, which is to say romance is of very strong interest to the audience. Drama, backstabbing is a very strong interest to the audience. And because we were building it like South Park in real time, we were able to adjust the scripts to lead into things that the audience were interested in. So they really liked two characters. They decided, even though there was zero romantic connection between them whatsoever in the story, that they were going to fake ship them. You know what they do in those fan communities where they draw fan art of them and they do these fan campaigns. And so by week 3, 4, we're seeing that. By week 6 or 7, we're starting to write a storyline. By week 10, they're a couple. So like, we're just building the show in real time based off of what the audience is interested in. And the third thing...
I'm sorry. Can I just jump in? Is there any fear of catering too much to the audience? I mean, do you ever worry like, well, this is the audience thinks they want one thing, but they don't actually want that? Or is that just not even in the equation?
We do think about that all the time. And most of the time it comes from the perspective of, well, you know, we're the writers and we want to tell our story, and how much of it is our story versus how much agency do we give the audience? And I think that that's where the creative challenge ends up coming from. And that became a real problem in Silent Hill and in the horror title. But that's an easier framework to understand. So I guess when we talk about that, I'll better answer your question.
Yeah,
but suffice to say that it was really a creative control question for the writers versus audience agency. The third thing that I quickly wanted to add in terms of learnings was things that traditionally work in games, in other words, like gameplay that audiences really like, work here also. The you know, most interesting puzzles were the ones that work the best traditionally on mobile games or PC. And so basically, if it's a good story trope and it's a good gameplay trope, the audiences are going to come to it if they're combined together, was the lesson that we learned. Now, do you want me to talk about the kind of Silent Hill version of where that story.
Well, let's see. In 1 second, because we should explain to folks. So you do Rival Peak for Facebook, and then you do I don't want to say similar versions, but not dissimilar versions of the same sort of idea for The Walking Dead and Silent Hill, which creates a new kind of interesting problem in that these are both IPs. Yep. They're intellectual properties that have like things that you have to kind of manage around them in corporate terms, and it's you know, with the creators, etc. So why don't you explain what some of the issues there were?
So let's start with how we went from Rival Peak to Pac-Man Community and Walking Dead with Meta. The VP of content at the time was Matthew Hennick, who's fantastic, and we loved working with him. And when we finished Rival Peak, we said, do you want us to do more Rival Peak? And he said, no, we want to 10x this. And the way in which we 10x audience is by bringing a big known intellectual property to it. So I canvassed lots of different IP holders, and I came back to him with Skybound and Walking Dead, who Kirkman's team just loves this stuff. They are fascinated by audience interactions. They are an incredible team in terms of thinking about where the future of media is going. And Kirkman's team came up with an entirely new cast of characters, some of the first characters he created since he finished the comic book run. Keep in mind, we were speaking to him in 2020, right? He just finished the comic book run, I think, 2019. So they build new character cast, they come up with the artwork, they come up with the story behind it, and we bring it to Hennick, and he greenlights it for a significantly bigger budget than what we did Rival Peak for. And so now we had all of the challenges of we're in a world that we don't control anymore ourselves as Genvid, right? This is Kirkman's world and Kirkman's rules and Kirkman's characters, and it's canon to his comic book series. So everything that the audience decides is officially part of the comic book story, right? Which is even more guardrails on it. But we were lucky in the Walking Dead project insofar as like Kirkman's team took the lead on creating those characters and coming up with the overarching story, which was the sandbox that we could play in. And so we didn't have to kind of test the rules there, right? But building for a series where the stakes are about life and death and not like a funny reality show is a very different type of story to write. And so we had to lean into this concept of the audience is going to choose who lives and dies each week in Robert Kirkman's world, as opposed to, you know, this fun story of what will happen to these characters. And so that's where I think the challenge came for us at the beginning.
I'm always fascinated by audience reactions to this question. I mean, one of the progenitors of the DC project was the Death in the Family storyline in Batman, which for folks who don't remember or too young to remember or weren't reading comics back in the 1980s, there was the audience was allowed to choose whether Robin lived or died, and they were given a 1-900 number to call, and the audience killed Robin. And I think everybody at DC was kind of surprised by this at the time, by the audience bloodlust. But I think in the intervening years, we have learned to expect that. Is that when you were working on this program, were you ever surprised when an audience choice led to a character death, or was that just kind of par for the course at this point?
This was the fascinating thing about both Walking Dead and Silent Hill, and this is actually the thing that I was going to start talking about related to your previous question, which is you think that the audience really wants to kill everyone. And the answer is no. The audience falls in love with characters and really wants to save everyone. So like imagine if you were to let the AMC audience save Rick, right? Or save Glenn or save like...
Save Glenn. That's the...
Right.
Yeah.
Any of them, right? Like... Would they? By overwhelming numbers, they would choose to save Glenn. Whether they would kill Rick or not, you know, another story. But, like, when they like a character, they get really pissed off if you kill them. And so what we saw was that characters they disliked, which is what happened with the original Robin. He was very annoying, Jason Todd.
Nobody liked Jason Todd.
So they killed him. But, like, when they fall in love with a character... They will do everything in their power to save them. And so what we saw in Walking Dead over and over was the audience went towards saving and good endings. And this was the real problem in Silent Hill, because we were building a horror television show, and a horror television show is about death, but we were giving the audience the ability to save those characters, and they saved 4 out of the 6 of them. And it's actually pretty boring television if the audience just keeps making these characters live and they keep saving them and people aren't dying. And so that was where the biggest creative challenge came from. So when we took this data from Walking Dead and from Silent Hill of the audience just constantly picking the good path and the winning path, and we said, we're not going to do that again with DC. We have to change the way that this works. So as another example, in Silent Hill, we started the experience with, we will tell you whether this choice will lead eventually to them being redeemed, damned, or suffering. And we thought, we're going to build a tug of war here. You know, like the heels and faces in wrestling, mm-hmm. like cheering and booing. And no, it was just overwhelming redeeming every single time. Like the gamers just get in there and they think, here's the win condition. I'm going to live. We're going to get to the end. This is going to be how we get 100% in this game. And so they just kept going green every single time, redeem every single time. And so midway through Silent Hill, it came on the stream one time because we were doing daily live streams and, you know, the dev team, we come in and we talk to the audience. I said, I'm taking away the labels. You're not going to know what the choices do anymore. And they were so angry at me. They were like, you're changing the rules. This is unfair. This is nonsense. But it made the experience much better once I took it away. So with DC, we were like, no, no explanation. You don't know where this is going to go. We're going to remove that label from you.
That's fascinating. Because it reminds me of, what's the Star Wars game where you can, depending on what you do, your character moves towards the light side and the dark side.
That was Knights of the Old Republic.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same basic idea there. And I always got the sense, or like with Bioshock, right? Like where Bioshock, you could save the little girl and you would get fewer experience points. But if you harvested her, you got more immediately, though they cheated. Because if you just kept saving her, you would get a bonus at the end that was equal. That's all. I've always thought that was a cheat. Bioshock, you guys,
cheap.
if you're listening to this, but I always got the sense that people almost always went for the good version of things, but maybe I'm just extrapolating from my friend group. I don't know.
They do, and that is the biggest problem. They try to save everyone. They try to get the best outcome because I think that people think that that's winning, right? Like a character getting to the end of the movie is how the movie should go. If the character dies midway through the movie, if Frodo just gets killed, Lord of the Rings is over, right? And so we see survival, we see getting to the end, we see accomplishing the goal as the winning condition, and people treat these as winning conditions. And so one of our advisors and investors is Cindy Holland, and from Netflix, who, you know, built a lot of their first interactive stuff, including Bandersnatch and Stranger Things and other things. And she gave me advice 4 years ago, which was in Bandersnatch, we were seeing the audience always tried to get the best ending first and then went to try to get the exact opposite next and see what the absolute worst was. They were interested in the extremes. So you have to build compelling extremes. But in our experiences, they're always ending up, you know, trying for that best run first, and that just gets dull for us. So with DC, we change things pretty radically. So you've brought up the fact that Lex is a good guy. Lex can go bad. Can go bad, you know, pretty quickly. But we will never give you that choice. It is going to be about what decisions you have Batman, Superman, or Wonder Woman make and how they interact with him that will change his kind of mindset toward them and put him on a different path. So we're never going to give you direct action here. It's almost like a psychological game that you have to figure out.
Will characters be able to make choices for Lex directly, or is it all through the other characters?
There are going to be choices that impact him more directly than others. But really what we're doing is, in DC, we've decided that the choices are about the interpersonal choices between this nascent Justice League, what leadership means, what morality means, what ethics are for superheroes. And I know that seems weird and like high level, but it's actually really important for this. Like, is Batman a team player or a loner? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? How does that inspire others? Right. And so Lex is going to see the way that they treat him, as an equal, look down to him, bring him in as a teammate or not, and then make his choices off of like their behavior and attitudes toward him. And where I find this interesting is, as an audience, we're creating difficult choices for you. You may see this as Batman winning, like he's going to beat this character in a fight, but it's going to cause him to be more of a loner. And so he's going to be more isolated from the Justice League, or he's going to be more isolated from Lex. And so what do you want? Do you want a stronger Batman, or do you want a stronger Batman-Lex relationship, or do you want a stronger Batman-Wonder Woman relationship? And we're going to make you have to choose between those, as opposed to just giving you everything that you're interested in.
Yeah. Again, it's so interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the actual animation, the animation styles, because there was one of the things that was kind of interesting about the Silent Hill game in particular is how realistic it was, but also that caused problems. Right.
Yes.
That was an issue for the viewers and the players.
Yep. So if people aren't familiar with Silent Hill, it's a major Japanese video game franchise. It's number two to Resident Evil. It's been around for 30 years. It's had close to 10 games at this point in time. Last month, they released Silent Hill 2 Remake, which sold millions of copies and has done tremendously well. There is a third film in the franchise coming out next year. So it's a big Japanese horror franchise. And we partnered with Bad Robot Games, J.J. Abrams' game studio, to do the character, creature, art, sound design. So it all came from them, and it's brilliant, and it's beautiful, and it's really high-fidelity Unreal Engine models that look like real people. We were using the MetaHuman system, which is Unreal Engine's new system for creating digital humans, and they just look ultra-realistic. But animating ultra-realistic humans is really hard and really expensive and takes a long time. We produced 20 hours of animation week to week, you know, in Silent Hill Ascension, which we did from last year up until this July, 9 months of live streams. And obviously, doing that over the course of 9 months and doing 10 times more what a Pixar film costs at a fraction of its budget and a fraction of its timeline, you know, is not going to result in Pixar quality animation. It's going to result in game engine quality animation. And most of the time, game engine quality animation is good if you're playing a game. But, go watch a video game for a second. Like, characters will kind of look to the side a little bit, or their eyes will not exactly be on you, or the camera will not exactly be in focus because you can move the camera around, right? It's not like television. It's not film like television. It doesn't have the same beats as television. The characters aren't exactly positioned the way that television is. And so it just created this massive uncanny valley between video game style kind of animation and camera work and other things and the high fidelity of the characters that we looked at it for DC. And we built all these models in very similar high fidelity. If you look at the DC project a year ago, they were all Unreal Engine 5 models, really high poly and like totally gorgeous and realistic. And just we're not going to be able to create that sense of disbelief. It just felt like you were watching a video game again. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. What we did was we reshaded the characters. We recolored them. So they're still the Unreal Engine 5 models that we built close to 3 years ago. And they're still really high fidelity, but they're now painted to look like 2D animation. And so now it looks like a really gorgeous cartoon, but it's animated in a unique and very fluid way, which you've seen watching the first episode.
Yeah.
So it looks quite different than the animation of a 2D Justice League series, but it still looks like a cartoon. And so you don't get that uncanny valley anymore. You just think this is really pretty animation. And that was the goal.
Yeah, no, it feels, this is, I'm sure I'm using the wrong term here, but it feels kind of like the cell shading sort of thing from Puss in Boots, the last,
yes.
the Last Wish, whatever the most recent Puss in Boots movie was, had a similar feel to it, I think, you know,
yep.
Obviously it's a slightly different look, but it was, but it's a nice look, it's like, it's a, you know, it's a fluid and yet different sort of vibe, which is nice.
Yeah, that was what we were going for. And, you know, that's what, if you watched Wild Robot, which came out in September, and mm-hmm. which is an absolutely gorgeous film, like, we've reached the peak of what fidelity means for computer animation at this point in time. Better fidelity doesn't necessarily make a better picture. And so it's gone, the pendulum has swung more toward, how can we make this artistic and differentiated and cool? And we're kind of going for the same there. And by the way, I think that video games are reaching that same kind of peak, which is to say, yeah. Sony's just released its PlayStation 5 Pro. Most of the reviews say it's super powerful, but it doesn't look any different. Like, you have to stand yeah. next to your television and look at a specific pixel and be like, wow, I guess that kind of looks a little bit yeah. different. And like that's very different than how games worked for 40 years. For 40 years, computing got better and visual fidelity got better, and audiences bought the next generation of content based off of improvements in visual fidelity, right? It's the Super Nintendo version of Mario looked better than the Nintendo version of Mario.
Right.
The Nintendo 64 version of Mario looked 3D for the first time. It felt different. The GameCube version looked very pretty, right? And so eventually it gets to a point where our ability to create a visual difference from Mario doesn't matter anymore. And yeah. so the pendulum swings from visual fidelity to gameplay. And that's where the industry is starting to change.
You say visual difference, but it's interesting because visual difference and visual reality are not the same thing, right? Like, so yep. when I'm discussing this, the thing that comes to mind is the history of art, right? The history of art. Painters become so good at painting realistic mm-hmm. images, we get to modernism, where, like, yes. all that breaks. And the combination of incredibly realistic painting and the rise of photography, which creates an actual image of the thing, an actual, you know, 100% faithful image, that leads to a reaction against that, which leads to modernism, cubism, whatever, exactly. you know, the and that does feel like that's kind of where certainly CGI, computer-generated animation is headed, away from that kind of, you know, away from the more realistic model towards the heightening, the animated effect. But also, I mean, I get the sense a similar thing is happening in video games, where you want things that are a little more cartoony, for lack of a better word, or a little more, you know, just highlighting the fact that it is, you know, outside of, you know, whatever, the Call of Duty, Modern Warfare, is whatever, the things where you want the absolute... I'm sorry, I'm rambling now, but I'm trying to...
the consumers have already voted with their wallets here, which is to say, Microsoft, about a year ago, released a game called Hellblade 2 Senua's Saga, which is probably the most visually stunning, realistic video game ever created. Didn't do particularly well, but, you know, meanwhile, Breath of the Wild, which is a very cartoony game, sold tens of millions of right. copies. And so the audience have made their decision. They are happy with Roblox and Minecraft and, you know, the visual fidelity they're getting. And what's more important to them is the gameplay and the experience they're having than how realistic something looks.
Yeah. And you can't run those things on cell phones, really. I mean, and that's where Correct. So much of gaming is shifting to, right, is the mobile
Yes.
experience. You can't do a PlayStation 5 Pro caliber image on your, even on, you know, I've got an iPhone 14 or whatever, pretty powerful phone, relatively speaking, but it can't run that.
It can't run it. And the question is the cost of developing those assets and developing that experience relative to the audience that you get on a console versus mobile. That cost equation is completely broken. And it's broken not just because of the cost of development, but because audiences have a very different set of content availability to them than what existed in the past, which is to say the following. When you and I are growing up, we're playing video games. The new Mario game would come out, or the new Zelda game would come out, or something else, and we would play it for X months, and then we would be done with it, and we would be looking for our next hit. We would be looking for our next piece of content, right? You don't go and watch the same movie in the movie theater 13 weeks in a row, right? If you're taking your girlfriend on a date, you're taking them to another movie, probably, unless you're really weird. But, like, you know, you were looking for that next piece of content. That doesn't exist anymore, right? People just go back to Fortnite. They go back to Roblox. They go back to Minecraft, and they go back to Call of Duty and others. And so video games are now closer to social networks when it comes to that kind of AAA live service experience relative to before. You have so much content out there. You're not in this kind of desert of what is my next game going to be anymore. I've played everything that's come out recently, because every game is constantly changing. Fortnite is different today than it was 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, it was Chapter 5. Now it's OG. In 2 weeks, it's going to be Chapter 6. It's a radically different product every single time, right? And lots and lots and lots of games are coming out. And so the game publishers are having difficulty in their businesses right now. And you see this with Ubisoft and other major public video game publishers, because they're finding their Star Wars game can't reach its numbers, right? You saw Ubisoft's stock price dip after they couldn't hit that. And they're doing so because the audience that would have come for that next Star Wars game, because, you know, they've just completed the previous game they were playing, is now satisfied with the sheer amount of content that they've got and are very, very hard to move away from the switching costs of the Fortnite kind of experience that they go back to each night. And so as an industry, we're not just struggling about how do we create this content? What do we create this content? How much does it cost to create this content? But how the hell do we get audiences to come and play our content when there are so many other options? It's not enough to be different anymore. You have to be better.
Yeah. No, this is just one of these things that makes me feel a billion years old, because I grew up doing the, I'm going to play Super Mario Brothers, and I'm going to go buy Contra. Then I'm going to play, you know, I don't know, World Cup 1990 or whatever. Like, exactly. I'm just running through my own personal library, Legend of Zelda, et cetera. And then, you know, and then you grow up and the PlayStation 2 comes out, and then I get to college and I play Counter-Strike for a while. And I'm like, oh, this is kind of fun, but also, like, not really my thing. I prefer the, you know, single player, the single player sort of thing. And that universe is gone, or it's going away pretty quickly.
Because the way that it used to work was you could count that there was a growing gaming audience, right? As kids aged up into an audience where they would play those games from like 6 to 13, that grew, and people who were 13 and 15 continued to play games. And so for 40 years, audiences who played games grew as an audience. You can go and you can see that chart of gaming hours growing. But eventually it becomes everyone, and eventually audience kind of red ocean emerges where every game is trying to get all of your time, not just 10 hours of your time, but all of your time, which is what happens with Fortnite. And then they become social networks, and you play Fortnite because your friends are there. And if you want proof of that, you can look at the fact that, you know, Ball again shared this chart, I think a month and a half ago, of, you know, gaming hours down from 2022 to 2024. And you look at TikTok hours up between 2022 and 2024, and they almost exactly overlap. In other words, the one and a half hour a week difference in gaming hours being played versus the one and a half hour difference in TikTok being watched over those 2 year period is almost exactly the same. And people don't have more time, right? So the more that you are doom scrolling TikTok, the less you are playing Candy Crush, or the less you are playing Call of Duty, and the more it is harming the game industry, because they are now social networks and they're competing with other social networks.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. Again, all right. So the show comes out. The show debuts November 20th. Can people download the app now? Is that available? How should people get involved?
So if you go to dcheroesunited.com, it'll have the links to the App Store and Google Play. And if you press the pre-registration button, it's going to pre-install the app for launch day. So on the 20th, the app will open. The first episode will be available. And the first choice will be available that day. The next day, Tubi will have the first episode. So Thursday, the 21st. And on Friday that week, the second choice will be available. Saturday, the third choice will be available. Sunday, we're going to unveil standings, so you're going to see how the choices are stacking against each other. Mm-hmm. Tuesday, we're going to start editing the episode. And Wednesday, November 27th, episode 2 goes live, and the races really begin. And, you know, we spend the next year just constantly making new content every week. It's going to be
This is one of the last thing I'll say here before my exit question is that we were discussing this, and like usually when you talk about a season of television, it's once upon a time it was 24 episodes, then that comes down to 21 episodes. Now it's really more like 8 to 10 episodes, depending on the streaming channel or the cable channel or whatever. But you're talking about doing a 24 episode season, right? Is that then taking a few weeks off and then doing another 24 episode season immediately after that?
Yeah, it's technically 16 episodes, but it's really unlimited, which is to say it just continues. It'll be 16.
I'm sorry, not 24. 16. Yeah. I got my multiple of 8 wrong. 16.
It doesn't. It's like Fortnite, right? You don't get, 2 months off. You don't get the summer off of a season of Fortnite, right? They just are constantly building that content. And in weeks where we have buys on the television, so like, Christmas week, we're not putting a new episode out just because it's not whatever. There's still game content. Like the game is still updating each week, no matter what happens. So even if we have an off week on television for whatever reason, we still have to put new game content out there. We still have to have new community content out there. We still have to have new live streams. So Tubi may not have an episode that week, but the game is still very active. And you don't have a choice there. Like, audiences demand regular engagement. You can't just have a game where there's nothing to do that day.
Yeah. Again, that sounds like a nightmare treadmill to be just a never ending. But I'm sure this is where the business is headed. I'm sure it's fantastically, lucrative because there is so much money sloshing around in this universe. It's wild. Looking at Matthew Ball's charts, just the amount of revenue that is. Spilling over is fantastic. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked. We covered a ton of stuff here, but is there anything folks should know about either this project or something else you're working on, or just anything about games or animation or interactivity? What did I not ask that we should have discussed?
I think that the last kind of point that I'm going to give to your audience is, if you think about the business models of television up until now, what we've seen is that traditional linear media really only operates at massive scale, which is to say, like, the winner of the streaming wars is clearly Netflix. That market hasn't been big enough for, a fourth place or even a third place to be there, right? It's going to be Netflix and probably Disney, and the rest of them are going to have to consolidate, right? Games are different. You can operate a video game by itself and be profitable for decades, right? There are games that have been out there for a very long time. Candy Crush is a good example, but Supercell's titles also, like, Clash of Clans and their titles. They, as a company, have been able to grow because they've operated just a handful of games. And so games don't operate at the same scale. And so I do think that building interactivity around your kind of linear media is going to be a winning strategy for parties that aren't Netflix. Really. Mm-hmm. Like if you're sitting in media today and you're looking at your company or your opportunity and you're not thinking about how can we go after the business models there that are there and interactive, forget just the audiences, but the business models that are there, I think that you're going to be in the wrong rat race. So it's the reason we built the business model around DC that we built, because we believe that being able to monetize and build audiences around community and this kind of video game experience are really the only way in which we're going to see content succeed that isn't just a very large streamer paying you.
Yeah. Jacob, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I loved it. I really appreciate being here.
Give the folks the website one more time just to tell them where to go.
Sure. It's dcheroesunited.com, or search for DC Heroes United on the app stores.
Yep. Again, this will be up. The app should be live on November 20th.
Yep.
Hopefully you have listened to this before. You've preloaded it. It's on your phone. You're ready to go. So thanks. Jacob, thanks again for being on the show. This was great.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free, Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.